You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In 15 years, Earth will lose thousands of glaciers every year. New science on peak glacier extinction from Switzerland glaciologist Lander van Schicht. Then off to Australia, where it's over 45 degrees C, 113 in the shade Fahrenheit, and it's burning again. Gazing into the flames with wildfire expert Hamish Clark. More and more buildings lost to wildfires in the United States. We've got Dr. Amanda Carlson on hand. So it's cold to really hot this week on Radio EcoShock. Under the barrage of worry, strange news, and pop-up wars, something really big is happening. Earth is losing glaciers rapidly. There are already funerals for them. A new study finds peak glaciation extinction is coming in the next few decades, depending on how hot and how fast we force the climate. Literally billions of people depend on glaciers, known as the water towers of the world. Can we slow down deglaciation? The paper in Nature Climate Change is Peak Glacier Extinction in the Mid-21st Century. We reached the lead author, Dr. Lander van Schicht, glaciologist at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. From Zurich, Lander van Schicht, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, all.
You say millions of people are attracted to glaciers, even though they are inhospitable places. Some glaciers are revered. What attracts us to these icy giants?
Well, it really depends on the person, but my personal feeling is that it's really the inaccessibility of glaciers. They are located high in the mountains in very remote valleys. You have to walk a very long way to see these icy giants. You have to take a train to reach these glaciers. And at the same time, you know that what you are seeing is transient. It's disappearing. And if you would come back the year afterwards, it would not look the same anymore. So it's really this combination of hard to see, hard to get a feeling about this landscape, and at the same time that it's only temporary, that makes these icy giants really special.
Right. Well, talk to us about the role of glaciers in the water cycle and why they are key for millions of people downstream.
Well, glaciers, they have a unique mechanism. In winter, when it's cold enough and when there is a lot of snow, then they accumulate fresh water in the form of snow that then over time transforms into ice. And then in spring and summer, when it gets warmer, when there is less snow, then glaciers start to melt and producing fresh water. So we call typically our glaciers natural reservoirs. They provide fresh water when people need it, when it's warm, when there is no rain, no snow. Then the glaciers make sure that the rivers are still flowing. So without glaciers, in dry periods, rivers might become dry. And this is especially relevant in very dry regions, like, for example, the Ganges or the Indus Basin in Southeast Asia. There, billions of people depend on the upstream glaciers during the summer months when they provide fresh water that is then used for irrigation, but also for industry and for domestic use.
According to the United Nations, around 10% of the world's land surface is currently covered by around 200,000 glaciers, which store approximately 70% of Earth's fresh water. But do we really know how many glaciers this planet has?
Well, we are constantly scanning the Earth with tens of satellites, and they are monitoring the Earth, and we identify flowing ice using multi-temporal satellite images. And if we identify this flowing ice, then we are sure that this is called a glacier, because the definition of a glacier is it needs to flow. And at the same time, it needs to have a minimum size of 0.01 square kilometers. So it needs to be 1 hectare. So by using satellites over multiple times, we can identify all these locations, all these ice areas that are large enough and flowing, and that we are sure that are glaciers. And so in doing this, we have identified more than 200,000 glaciers at present. However, there are also some regions where there is a lot of ice beneath rocks beneath debris, and this is much more difficult to identify with satellites. So probably this 200,000, it's a lower limit of the number of glaciers we have, but it captures the majority of the big glaciers that we are sure of.
Do you include glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica in your study, or would these monster ice fields distort the picture in the rest of the world?
Yeah, they would distort the picture indeed, because they are very large, as you say. They melt, they have different dynamics. So we focus on all glaciers except for Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. So typically glaciologists, or they focus on the glaciers, or they focus on the ice sheets. And in this study, we focus on all glaciers except for Greenland and Antarctica.
And how do you define peak glacier extinction, and what can we do with this number?
Well, we have modeled every individual of these 200,000 glaciers, and we have identified when each of these 200,000 glaciers would disappear. That means getting too small to be called a glacier anymore, or becoming too small so that the volume is smaller than 1% of its initial volume, its present-day volume. And in doing this, we identified the extinction year for every glacier, and by summing all these glaciers disappearing in an individual year, we then calculated the number of glaciers disappearing on Earth for every year between 2025 and 2100. Then we identified that this pattern showed a peak in the middle of the century. And this peak means that at that time, we lose in one year most glaciers of all the time periods. So for example, in a 2.7 degree warming world, we lose 3,000 glaciers every year in the 40s, between 2040 and 2050.
And there is a huge variation in glacier loss. Two glaciated areas plunged down to 40% less mass now than they had in 1960. These are in Central Europe, including the Alps, and Western Canada and USA. On current trends, Glacier National Park in the U.S. will have no coming glaciers in coming decades. Why is ice loss so steep in Europe and Western North America?
Well, these two mountain ranges, they have a lot of very small glaciers at present. And so because of climate change, the mass balance is getting negative, so we're losing mass over time. And these very small glaciers, they have almost no buffer for these high loss rates we will observe in the coming 1, 2, 3 decades. So all these small glaciers, they disappear very soon. And this means that the peak in glacier extinction for example, Western Canada and USA and Central Europe will occur pretty soon, just because all these small glaciers, they disappear within the next 3 decades. So only the medium and larger size glaciers remain, but they are much, much less common. So we only have a few very big glaciers in these mountain ranges that will survive in the second half of the century. On the opposite side, another reason is that these two mountain ranges, they are very sensitive to climate change. So temperature increases not only increase the melt in summer, but also decrease the snowfall in winter. And so this combination makes the glaciers in these mountain ranges also very vulnerable to climate change.
Your new paper includes the cultural significance of glaciers, but on our current emissions and 4 degrees C of warming by 2100, glaciers in Central Europe almost completely disappear, a huge change from all human history. How will this change Europe and Europeans, do you think?
Well, exactly. So thousands, even millions of visitors, they go to glaciers to see these icy giants. And what we see in a 4-degree warming world is that there will only be 20 glaciers remaining in Central Europe. And these 20 glaciers, they will also be only located at the very high peaks of the mountain range. So they will also not be accessible. They will not be reachable with public transport. So it will be not possible anymore for tourists to visit glaciers. So it will change the entire landscape of the Alps, that's for sure, but it will also change the economy and touristic landscape of the region. So somehow we need to rethink the tourism of the Alps for a future without any glacier.
How about glaciers in the Andes in South America? How are they doing?
They're doing slightly better at the moment, so there are a lot of big, medium to big size glaciers. And what we see for these mountain range, Southern Andes, is that there is a huge difference between a 1.5 degree warming world, the Paris Agreement, and a plus 4 degree warming world by the end of the century. So depending on the scenario, we could save thousands of glaciers in Southern Andes, while for other mountain ranges, the difference between the scenarios is much smaller. So every 0.1 degree temperature change we can prevent will save a lot of glaciers in the Andes. And that's one of the regions where this impact is the highest.
You co-authored and were lead author of several studies of glaciers in Kyrgyzstan, Central Asia. To begin, where are the Tian Shan, the celestial mountains?
The Tian Shan is a very big mountain range in Central Asia. So it covers parts of Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, China, and it has more than 10,000 glaciers. And these glaciers, they extend from 2,000 meters above sea level up to 7,000 meters above sea level. So there is a very diverse landscape of glaciers in Central Asia.
And what is happening with those Central Asian glaciers, and why are scientists like you investigating changes there?
Well, they follow the global trends with mass loss, and mass loss that is increasing over time. So glaciers in Central Asia, they're also getting smaller. We are also losing glaciers in Central Asia. And for that specific region, it's very important for the water availability. So Central Asia is a region where there is precipitation in winter and spring, but where the summers are very dry. So that's really an example of a region where the glaciers are natural reservoirs that store ice in winter, release fresh water in summer. So without glaciers, without these buffers of droughts, rivers might become dry, and this would mean a catastrophe for downstream irrigated areas. The soils, the lands around the mountains in Central Asia is very fertile, but because of the dry climate, it's not possible to do agriculture without irrigation. And the water needed for irrigation is coming from the glaciers. So then you can make the circle. Without glaciers, there is no irrigation, there is no agriculture possible in that area.
Tell us about glacier funerals and the global glacier casualty list.
Well, glaciers, they have a very high cultural value. And these glacier funerals, they are a very good example of that. So since 2019, many different mountain ranges and the people in these mountain ranges, they're organizing funerals, glacier funerals. And that means going up the mountain with tens of people to visit the place where the glacier was located for decades, for thousands of years. And so they're going to these locations to give speeches, both religious speeches, but also speeches by glaciologists, to tell them what the glacier meant for them. So it's really a ceremony to give a final greeting to the disappearing glacier. At the other side, the global glacier casualty list is a list where we aim to remember glaciers. So there is a very big data set where we observe or where we include glaciers that we are sure that are lost over time, and we include them in this list together with stories of these glaciers, with old pictures of these glaciers, to remember them, that we will never lose how they looked like in the past.
Your new assessment doesn't go into one devastating glacial change when Glacial Lake Oostbeek floods suddenly and wash away buildings and lives downstream. Are those too short-term for this kind of analysis?
They are short-term, and most important is that to investigate these Glacial Lake Outburst floods, we need very complex models, so often 3D models where we can really go in detail for specific glaciers. And that's opposite to the more simpler models we used for this study, but that allowed to study 200,000 glaciers. So to go into detail about these natural hazards that are accompanied with retreat of glaciers, we need much more complex and detailed studies on individual glaciers.
Your group finds peak glacier extinction around 2041 if we had kept to the Paris goal of just 1.5 degrees of warming. We expect peak extinction to come even sooner in a hotter future, like 4 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial. But counterintuitively, you find a hotter world delays the extinction line, and an earlier peak is more optimistic. Why is that?
Well, that's because in a more optimistic scenario, we only lose the small glacier. They will be lost in a 1.5 degree already by 2040, and they will also be lost in a 4 degree warming by 2040. But in addition to these small glaciers, we also lose medium-sized glaciers in a 4 degree warming world. So they come on top of the small glaciers, and they are disappearing slightly later than the small glaciers. So combining the small glaciers disappearing anyway and the medium and some large glaciers, we see a shift in the peak towards later times. And the peak is also higher, twice as high as in a 1.5 degree warming world for a 4 degree warming world.
Looking at current fossil fuel investments and build out, I worry by the end of this century, Earth will heat up to 4 degrees hotter than before the industrial age. Suppose we save ourselves and we keep that to 2.7 degrees of warming. What difference would that make to world glaciers?
Well, we see that the impact of limiting to 2.7 instead of 4 would save up to 25,000 glaciers. So it means by the end of the century, we have 25,000 glaciers more left than in a 4-degree warming world. And that makes a huge difference because every individual glacier can be important as a provider of fresh water, as a tourism magnet, as a contributor to sea level rise. So we see that we can save 25,000 glaciers if we can limit the global warming to 2.7 instead of plus 4.
2025 was the United Nations International Year of Glaciers Preservation. Did anything happen?
Well, this year was specifically designed to get more attention to glaciers and the importance of glaciers. So there were a lot of initiatives. There were speeches. There were movie events. There were new research collections with many research from all over the world. So there was much more attention to the glaciers and the importance of them in this specific year. And it was also the start of the decade of climate action for cryospheric science. So I feel that because of the attention, people are more aware now of the impact of climate change on glaciers. And let's hope that this is a very good start to take more action and to save glaciers in the coming years, in the coming decades.
Reading this paper, I pick up a sense of personal sadness. Lander, you spent time on these ice giants. How does the chronicle of changes in the ice world make you feel?
Well, I'm really passionate about glaciers, and I try to go as often as possible to glaciers to have a glimpse on these icy mountains. And I feel very sad if I return every year to the same glaciers and you really observe from the first row what we are losing. If you're going to a glacier, you're standing on ice of 10 meters thick. You go the next year again, and you're standing on better. Then this is very sad to see. It's very sad to observe from the first row what exactly we are losing.
What got you studying glaciers? How did you get involved in this cold world?
Well, from when I was young, I started hiking in the mountains, looking at the mountains and at the glaciers. I did my first glacier hike when I was 5 years old, so I got this passion from my parents, probably, that took me to the mountains. And then a bit later on, when I was studying geography, I got a chance to start investigating glacier changes using drones. And that's what made me really passionate and motivated to study the impact of climate change on these glaciers, and not only by monitoring them, by measuring them, with measurement devices with drones, but also by using models like we use now in this new study.
Your group ends the new paper by saying we still have agency. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's because we show how many more glaciers we can save if we limit the warming to 2-degree warming world, which is still possible, to a 2.7-degree warming world, which is following current climate policy promises, and in a 4-degree warming world. So we see that there is a huge difference between these scenarios. So we could save thousands of glaciers the sooner we can limit temperature rise.
What are you studying now, Lander?
Well, we're developing our glacial models further. So far we're using monthly climate forcing data, average monthly temperature and precipitation, to get insights into the mass balance of glaciers. And what we're now trying is to use daily climate forcing data. And this will give us much more details into intra- and inter-annual variability. And we are sure that this will also show an impact and will have an impact on the numbers we're putting forward.
From ETH Zurich, we have been speaking with glacier expert Dr. Lander van Tricht. Among his many papers in the field, Lander is lead author of the December 2025 paper, Peak Glacier Extinction in the Mid-21st Century. Find links to all the science and news in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Lander, thank you for spending time with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We are divided into two camps, those who personally fear wildfires and those who don't. They should. Fires are popping up in unusual places, unhealthy smoke reaches just about everywhere, and carbon from superfires could speed up climate change. There is more, but that's the short list for why all of us need to get the big picture. We reached the author of a new review. It's called Gazing Into the Flames, A Guide to Assessing the Impacts of Climate Change on Landscape Fire. The lead author is Dr. Hamish Clark. He is senior fellow at the Flare Wildfire Research Group at the University of Melbourne. From Melbourne, Hamish Clark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
Australia has a lot of fire experts, and there's a good reason for that. Tell us about the recent extreme fire warnings in Australia just recently.
Yeah, there's a bunch of fires burning in Victoria, where I'm normally based, and New South Wales, where I'm currently on holiday visiting family. The ones in Victoria are of particular concern. A number of them are up at the emergency warning level. So that's essentially saying that it's not possible to control them. And so people need to enact their plans and leave the area and, you know, take whatever action they can to protect themselves. So, yeah, it's pretty awful conditions right now. My hometown, close to Melbourne, is forecast of a top temperature of 45 degrees Celsius today, which is pretty much unheard of for that part of Melbourne, although it can get hot. So, yeah, things are quite extreme at the moment.
I think when it comes to sort of adding up the media, the city fires burn into our memory. And for North Americans, it may be the town of Lahaina in Hawaii, 2023, and certainly Los Angeles a year ago. Tell us about the Black Summer fires in your part of the world.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Australia has a history of fire, as you pointed out. It's got a history going back millions of years, and then it's got tens of thousands of years of indigenous use of fire. But since colonization, there's been a number of major events, and they've been labeled after the day that they happened. As, you know, Red Thursday, Black Saturday, Black Friday, Ash Wednesday. And so Black Summer was so big that they said a day couldn't handle it. It had to be a season. And to be honest, it was well longer than a season. This was a series of fires, essentially in the southeast and southwest. And it's worth pausing for a moment to acknowledge Australia's, as you noted in your introduction, a very fire-prone place, a very large place, and a real rich diversity of fire regimes. And so we have massive fires in sparsely populated kind of arid areas, grasslands, savannas. And so sometimes this gets mixed up with the other fires that we have in the southeast and southwest. And they're all, you know, important and interesting for their own reasons. So anyway, the Black Summer fires, predominantly in the east, southeast and southwest, kind of started in September or even earlier than that in some places and worked their way down and kept burning through until we had some heavy rain. I think it was possibly around February. And so they basically burnt an unprecedented area. We hadn't seen this amount of area burnt. We'd never seen this amount of area burnt at high severity. So this is not just the footprint of the fire, but the actual nature of the burning. You know, it's kind of getting up into the crown, the canopy of trees, and, you know, scorching or even consuming that. You know, and it came off the back of really extreme conditions. You know, we had our hottest and driest year on record in 2019, and there'd been, you know, drought in large areas before then. And then we had a series of, you know, kind of terrifyingly, spectacularly dangerous fire weather days. It was just kind of relentless. And the toll was awful too. I think around 33 people died directly as a result of it. Thousands of homes were lost. And as we're increasingly understanding, you know, the indirect effects, things like smoke, I mean, arguably that's a direct effect too, but massive effects of smoke on health. You know, studies have found that hundreds of people died because of the amount of smoke. And of course, all the other, you know, effects that we care about too on the environment and the economy and cultural values and all those things. So it was a pretty incredible season. And I suppose the scary footnote to it is, unfortunately, these conditions are expected to become more common.
In your new review, you say landscape fire is a prototypical extreme-driven system. What do you mean?
Yeah, so this is a point some of my co-authors are really keen to make, in that I guess if you take a step back and you look at any kind of environmental phenomenon of interest, you can ask about the kind of statistical behavior of it, if you like. You know, you can draw a bell curve, for example. You measure anything, it often follows this kind of bell-shaped distribution where there's an average and then you kind of values at the extremes on either side, whereas the point they're trying to make with fire is, at least in many systems, it doesn't happen that often. And when it does happen, it's often only a small fire, but then the big fires dominate impacts. So these are relatively rare, but they're relatively large, and they certainly dominate the impacts in terms of area burnt, fire severity, you know, life loss, house loss, and those things. So I guess there's understanding fire in all its forms and all its shapes and sizes. But then there's understandable interest in going to those extremes, you know, and that might be based on extreme weather, extreme dryness, various other factors. So that's what we mean by being a kind of an extreme-driven event.
Would you talk to us about the poleward expansion of fires right up into the formerly frozen tundra and I presume also in the southern hemisphere?
Yeah, this is an interesting area. Again, it's a bit scary and not my area of expertise too, I should say, but essentially, as the globe warms, you know, we're seeing warming happening right throughout it. And if you think about fire as a phenomenon, it's got a few really important kind of environmental drivers or switches, if you like, and they all need to be in the on position to get a fire, right? So you need fuel, you need something to burn. That fuel's got to be dry enough to burn, you know, so rainforests don't typically burn, for example. You need the right weather conditions, you know, it's often that kind of hot, dry, windy day, and then you need an ignition. And so in our more kind of polar regions, the temperatures usually aren't that high, the vegetation's usually not that dry. So as conditions change, unfortunately, we're seeing more fire in those areas. So there's obviously a lot more detail behind that, but essentially that's kind of it. We're seeing some of these switches start to turn on that in the past wouldn't have been on, or they would have been on extremely rarely. You kind of zoom out to the climate system more broadly, some of the most terrifying and spectacular warming has been seen in Arctic regions. You know, we're seeing areas that are, you know, recording 20 degrees above the kind of historical climate average. So, yeah, it's really an area of concern, and you'll often see scientists talking in papers about not just different risk in areas that are currently fire-prone, but, you know, all of a sudden areas that formerly weren't particularly fire-prone are becoming, and so there's obviously a lot that they need to do to start thinking about and preparing for those conditions where they potentially didn't have as much experience of doing so in the past.
A 2025 study led by Saeed Saidi found, quote, the population directly exposed to wildland fires increased 40% globally from 2002 to 2021, despite a 26% decline in burned area, end quote. So more people are moving into fire risk zones. When you weigh impacts, how does that demographic factor compare to climate drivers? Is it possible to even sort them out?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting area and an important area. And I think increasingly it will be possible to sort those out. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of obvious. If we build houses in areas that are known to be fire prone, then, you know, there's a risk that we're exposing ourselves to. And, you know, this is the pattern of development in large areas of the world. You know, we start small and then we work our way out. And it's often that interface, you know, it's sometimes called the wildland-urban interface or WUI, although it doesn't mean the same thing to people in Australia. But it's essentially where the bush or the vegetation meets people. So, yeah, it's definitely a factor. You know, there's a different kind of risk compared to fires that are happening in more remote areas or fires that are happening in more urban areas, tend to be kind of house or building fires rather than kind of vegetation driven. People are trying to understand what can we do to reduce the risk and what are the factors, how much of it comes from, let's say, the bush or the vegetation, how much of it comes from how we're building our homes and designing our settlements, things like that. So yeah, I haven't seen too many attempts to kind of try and partition out, you know, this much from the climate, this much from dryness, this much from development at the interface, but those kinds of studies are becoming more common. And in fact, one of my co-authors on this paper, Francesca De Giuseppe, is one of the leaders of a big fire mapping project called State of Wildfires, where they are literally trying to look at major events like the LA fires, big Canadian fires over the previous year, and ask, okay, well, how much of this do we think was weather-driven, dry?